Welcome to the Hatch Podcast for Hive.
So this is Luke Worthy interviewing Tim Leach, historical fiction writer. Hi Tim, thanks for talking to me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The first question I wanted to ask is, what has been your journey to becoming a writer and to publication?
Yeah, good question. I'll try and be concise. I mean, I studied English and creative writing at university. Originally, I wanted to be an actor, but then I started getting more interested in writing and really got into it in a big way at university. I loved the course. I loved the experience of it. And I knew I wanted to continue doing it after I graduated. So I moved to London and had my day job working as a copywriter and was getting up every morning to go to a cafe beforehand and do some work, some writing work rather. And after a few years of that, I decided I wanted to come back and do an MA to really focus in on a project, because I sort of felt like I'd gone away to do some more kind of development. I really wanted to kind of have a really focused year to kind of work on something. And that was what became my my first book, The Last King of Lydia. I wrote most of a first draft of that during the MA, essentially. And then once I'd finished it, I edited it up a bit, showed it to some agents. One of them said no, another one said yes and was keen. So then worked with her to edit it up for a period of, it was about 9 months. I mean, to get to the second draft, which I sent out to the agent, was about a year and a half. And then there was another 9 months of bouncing various edits backwards and forwards with the agent. Once she felt that it was ready to go, she took it to a bunch of editors. And again, some of them said no, some of them said maybe, and then one of them said yes, definitely yes. And so they picked that one up for a two-book deal, and then I was away.
Yeah, that sounds good. And do you find like writing in the morning better than writing at any other time of day?
I used to be pickier. I mean, I used to be very much a morning writer. I'm a bit more flexible now. Evenings are not so good for me. I start to get sleepy. I usually find that either the sort of period between breakfast and lunch or the period immediately after lunch for a few hours tends to be where I'm most productive. Later in the afternoon, my energy starts fading away a bit for writing anyway. And the evenings, I can get it done in the evenings, but it's tough.
Yeah, it's kind of a nice thing to do. Like, it's energizing in the morning. Mm. Like, lots of writers have like morning pages, don't they, where they
Yeah, I mean, I think the nice thing about it, for me at least, is that, it's one of the best bits of advice I got from and he said it as being it's a shame it works this way, but the way to get somewhere in writing a lot of the time is to get yourself to a position where you're unhappy if you've not written that day. You know, lots of that kind of conditioning. And so, and that is true. And it's the kind of the gentle whip that cracks and kind of gets you going. But the downside of that is, so if you get that done, and that's what I found when I was working down in London, that's the reason that I wanted to get up early and do it. It was partly because when I'd come home, I'd just be completely boxed. You know, I'd been working all day and commuting, doing a big London commute. And all I wanted to do was just sit and eat and chat to my friends and then go to sleep. So part of it had no energy in the evenings. Yeah. But it was also really nice. I do remember that sensation, which still exists now to a certain extent, of knowing that, it was the thing that was most important to me, and I'd got it done by like 9 o'clock. And that really sets you up. It really sets you up nicely for the day. When you're like, that's the one thing that I really, really want to do today is to write. Yeah. And I did that. And now I can just enjoy the rest of the day. Yeah. So again, as the day draws on, if I've not got the writing done, I start to get twitchy and angsty and it kind of makes it harder to work.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so why historical fiction?
Yeah, I kind of ended up in it by accident, really. I sort of tried just about every other genre and form up to that point. I don't know why it didn't occur to me earlier, really. But really, it was just I was going through, I was trying to catch up on lots of reading that I felt like I'd missed. You know, it's the peril of doing English, obviously, is that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. You do a bit of reading, and then after that, you discover that all it does is make you aware of how much you haven't read.
Yeah.
So after I graduated university, I was going on these blitzes of going through stuff, like went on a run through the big Russian novels, and then I'd gone through one on the classics, which again, I'd never really read. And just came across the story in Herodotus's histories for what became my first book, and just loved it. I loved the story that was there. I loved the world of it. It felt kind of unfinished, and I knew I wanted to write it. And then I was like, oh, I guess I'm writing historical fiction. And then I tried writing it and found it really, really appealed to me. It really stuck with me. I think maybe partly it's because I used to be a really big fantasy reader when I was a kid, you know, and that's maybe why I've ended up in kind of ancient and medieval. And, you know, I don't think that I'd want to write I don't think it would be in my skill set necessarily to write fantasy now. I don't think I've got that particular mindset. But that the world that it kind of presented, that sort of more technologically simple, kind of primal, even in a secular sense, kind of magical and superstitious kind of world that I was reading in the historical fiction, then got to write, really appealed to me. So,
yeah. So part of the genre is obviously world building. So what is it about world building that interests you as a writer? And how do you kickstart a world into creation?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I suppose in terms of research for historical fiction, it's what's similar and what's different, I suppose. And that's the fun interplay that you get with historical fiction, because that's what drew me into the genre, really, was reading the source material was, you know, sometimes there's just deeply, what now seem to be like deeply strange, really interesting, exotic worlds and cultures and customs and this sort of thing that are fascinating in that respect. But then every so often, people will behave in such recognisably human ways that you feel that such direct connection. You feel the sort of the thousands of years melting away, and you see, oh yes, you were a person like me, and you live in this culture where you're, you know, sacrificing bulls to the moon and doing all this kind of stuff, but also you loved and you feared and you struggled, and there's that kind of human connection there. So I think I'm always trying to look at what's unusual and therefore interesting, and it's a really interesting new lens to kind of look at something. To this is a culture, or this is a custom, or this is a time, or this is a place that has faded away now and is therefore really interesting to look at in a historical sense, but also what's the human point of connection, where's the similarity and where's the familiarity with the world that you can kind of find your way into.
So I recently just read Smile of the Wolf. I really loved it.
Oh, thank you.
I was wondering, where did the idea come from?
It was good. It came from a footnote, actually. Because I was doing some reading, and I wasn't even casting. I was working on something else at the time that didn't pan out. But my dad had like got me into the Icelandic sagas, and was reading them. I was kind of gradually falling in love with the world of it. And then there was this footnote about, because there's a, you know, the opening story to Smile of the Wolf is in one of the sagas, the story of the guy that's buried beneath his house and is haunting the land. And there was a little footnote around it that the Icelandic ghosts and the Norse ghosts were very physical. You know, they wouldn't like spook you to death. You know, they'll come at you with an axe. Yeah. They'll really come for you. They're more like what we would call kind of like zombies, but with a sort of sentience to it.
Yeah.
And that really intrigued me. And then it was the idea around. And with stuff like that, I suppose the kind of historical fiction I write is non-directly magical in that way. So I'm always trying to think of how does that story get started? You know, what's the quote-unquote rational kind of explanation for this sort of thing? And then it was like, oh, what would it be? Why would someone be pretending to be a ghost? And then obviously then the story started rolling from there.
Kieran, I'm saying that right, Kieran?
Oh, I hope so. It's kind of like, I think it's a kind of, Kieran is probably the, because it's a kind of alternate spelling or earlier spelling of Kieran, I think.
As a Kieran, the narrator of your novel is a poet that trades stories for food and songs for shelter. How important do you think stories are in the world?
Oh, really, really important. I really do believe in that. You know, I'm a buyer of my own medicine in that kind of respect. I mean, I think that we're narrative creatures. You know, I think that we tell stories all the time. You know, we tell stories about ourselves, and that's how we understand our own lives, and it's how we understand the world, it's how we understand the people around us. So I think that there's a wonderful John Steinbeck quote, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, it's about writers are like distant stars sending signals, and you know that we're lonesome creatures, and we spend all our lives trying to not feel as alone. And one of the ways that you can do that, one of the oldest kind of primal methods, is to tell or to or to read a story that says, you know, that thing that you felt, I felt that too. You know, you're not as alone as you thought. So I think they're the way that we connect, the way that we understand the world. So, yeah, I would say it, perhaps, but I think they're massively important.
It would be a bit strange if you
didn't. Yeah, it's like, no, I hate them. You know, they're rubbish.
Okay. The reunion between Sigrid and Kieran was not a pleasant or romantic reunion of lovers readers were perhaps expecting. What was the reason you chose to create it this way?
I think it was a combination of things. I mean, one of them was surprise, I suppose, you know, that you're always sitting in front of, think, how can I subvert an expectation to a degree? I also just thought, you know, it's that thing, you know, that I was, when I was thinking it through, and I didn't have that fully planned out. That was, you know, there's some stuff that I plan, there's some stuff that I don't. And that was, I think, one of the, and I just think about it, I just think that you'd think, that he was a bit of a dick, you know. Yeah. So, you know, when you're thinking about it from her point of view, yeah, that when he had, you know, he had behaved in such a way, and you know, and I think that for her character, she was someone that was very much kind of anti-feud, basically, yeah, and she's, you know, and a lot of it was to think about what it was to be a woman in that world, surrounded by all these men, just so endlessly concerned with their honour and yeah, their pride and, yeah, you know, killing each other over it and destroying families and destroying lives and this kind of thing. And I thought that it would be the thing that she would hate, you know, yeah, you know, the thing that she admired about him or liked about him or loved about him was as a good person, but also someone who was willing to try and escape the tangle of the feud. And that, yeah, when he stays, it's very much him committing to it in that sense. Yeah. It's, you know, it's the heroic flaw, really. You know, he should just go, you know, get out of there, you know, sort of come back, you know. It's, but he's almost too proud to go.
Yeah.
And so for her, I felt that would be a line that he would cross, that it would then kill off what she felt for him.
Yeah. Okay, so the character Vigdis has a lot of power in the novel. She strikes a lot of fear, like, throughout the book. Like, I've noticed, like, lots of the endings appear with endings of the parts, and, like, she was always at the end of them. Did you see her as completely evil? And is there a reason that you cast her as a woman?
You're definitely not completely evil, you know. I sort of, I think that she's a very damaged and kind of broken character, and has just as many sort of damaged and broken people are when they find an opportunity for power. It's incredibly seductive when you've been powerless for a lot of your life, and then suddenly you discover a way that you can have power and you can have agency. For a lot of people, that's tremendously seductive. For her being a woman, I mean, it was one of the fascinating things in the sagas, again, one of the things that drew me to the world, was how, in some ways, indirectly powerful so many of the women were. And there were, there's lots of cases in the sagas where you see women who were relatively progressive rights for the time. You know, it's still 1000 AD, you know, sort of feminism is a long way off in that respect. Yeah. But, you know, they could divorce their husbands, they could own property, and they often wield surprising amounts of power within the sagas where they're able to use these, and maybe as a contrast to Sigrid, perhaps. Yeah. Sigrid is just hates this kind of honour code bullshit, and, you know, wants to be rid of it and free of it. Whereas for Vigdis, she's learned to, it's her source of power. Because she's like, if I tell that guy, you're a coward unless you fight him, he's going to go fight him, because that's the thing that he fears the most. Yeah. And so, and there's lots of characters like that within the sagas as well. There are women who have discovered, this is, you know, I'm going to fight indirectly through, and I'm going to take part in the feud myself. And
I remember a quote from the book, actually, where you said something like, one of the characters says, a woman's word has more power than a man's word.
I forgot, it's been long since I wrote it, but that sounds like the kind of thing I would write. And it was for that sort of thing, because, again, it was part of that culture where they had that ability to egg people on in that sort of way.
Yeah, I suppose leading on to that, the next question, the book seems to be about loyalties, where you can either be a hero or a coward. Do you think these themes are still relevant today?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we're always being, less dramatically, perhaps, for the most part, you know. I mean, you know, and that's part of the fun, I suppose, of fiction writing, is and particularly historical fiction. Again, it's what draws me in, is that just that ability to turn up the pressure, you know, because of the society, because of the culture, because of the presence of danger, is tremendously exciting for me to write. But yeah, I mean, I think we're always, it's one of the things that fascinates me, I suppose, is that when do you stick to your beliefs, and when do you bend, and when do you stand firm? When do you draw the line and say, no, I'm not going to compromise on this, I'm going to hold my ground? When do you go, oh, maybe, all right, I'll bend a little bit? And when do you find yourself breaking that kind of code? You know, and we all do this all the time in our working lives, in our romantic lives, in our sort of friendships and this sort of thing. We're always dealing with these questions of loyalty and codes of honour. So it was a chance to look at them in a sort of more intense sort of way.
Yeah, interesting. So I said, like, I highlight my book with favourite quotes. So one of my favourite quotes was, harder to sharpen a spear than to use it, easier to kill a beast than to skin it, easier to kill a man than to bury him. So this is one of my favourite quotes. How do you come up with these kinds of, like, philosophies?
Yeah, I can't remember this. I can't remember that. I think that is a Tim Leach original. I don't think, you know, I mean, sometimes there will be, I think there's a bit, I can't remember the line now, there's a line earlier on, it's part of a song that he sings to Gunnar early on, which is taken from
it. I did notice it was repeated.
Yeah, well, I think there's one which is, it's around, like, one winter makes one a guest and two makes someone a thief, and that is somewhere in the sagas or somewhere in the kind of Norse stuff that I was reading. I think that was an original. I mean, for me, it was just, I think that was an idea around, maybe it's a theme that I return to, I suppose, is that the... You know, the problem and difficulty of violence, and you know, the and you know, a lot of what you know, and I hope that I don't, my interest is not in kind of glorifying violence, but it's interesting to me, and I suppose a lot of it, the interest for it is stuff like that, where it's a very you know, particularly in that kind of world, it's a very tempting solution. It presents itself almost as an easy solution, you know, that thing, just destroy the thing that is making you upset. You know, we all have that ever since we're a kid and we just want to break stuff and that sort of thing. But you know, inevitably, it's more difficult and complicated and upsetting than you think, and so that's one of the ideas that was rattling around in my head as I was writing a book about feuds and violence and that sort of thing. So that was an opportunity, I think, to try and find a way to make it a kind of aphorism in the world.
Yeah, we find out the reason for the title, "The Smile of the Wolf," towards the end of the story. But did you always have this title in mind when you began writing, or did you have a working title?
Yeah, it's funny that the title. Actually, I'm really bad with titles. They always come out. They always come out later on.
Yeah,
and that was a funny one because the line was in there. The idea that the smile of the wolf is, or a smile like a wolf, or whatever is in the text. But the title actually came out because we were when the agent was trying to sell it. I think my original title for it, which I think is ponderous, is. Was The Duty of Revenge, which again was the, you know, maybe a bit too on the nose. And then when my agent read it, she was like, "How about, you know, The Feud?" And I thought, "Oh, it's okay. I mean, maybe sure. Let's go with that." You know, it didn't quite feel right to me, but I thought I just couldn't think of a better one, basically. Yeah. And then we were trying to sell it around, and then we sold it to bizarrely, we ended up selling the Spanish rights first. And then the Spanish translators, I think just The Feud didn't sound very good in Spanish. And then one of them had found this line in it, which I couldn't remember writing, about the smile of the wolf. And they said, "Yeah, and we just came across this line and we thought, how about we're going to call it La Sonrisa del Lobo," which, you know, which sounds great in Spanish. And then we basically just stole it back and then started selling it, you know, trying to sell it to a UK publisher under the name The Smile of the Wolf. So yeah, it was the line was in there, but it was certainly came about pretty much the last thing we figured out for the book.
So in general, for your novels, how much research do you tend to do, and does that involve travel? Like in The Smile of the Wolf, how much of the history of Iceland did you create yourself? For example, is the Althing real or fiction?
Oh yeah, that the Althing's real, like and that's was tremendously fun to write. And as soon as you're reading about it, it's often in the old sagas, it's often where lots of stuff always goes wrong at all things. You know, they're great places because you've got all these characters gathering in one place, like a pressure cooker, and there's horse fights, which always seem to end in a fight. You know, there's duels and there's legal cases, because it's where you would go, because they would have, once a year. It's an amazing place. It's an extraordinary, because to tag on with that, I did go to Iceland with my dad. We went on a kind of saga road trip, basically. So we just hired a camper van and sort of drove around all the sites. I mean, that was part of the appeal for it. I'd not done the kind of on-the-ground research for the first couple of books, partly through just didn't have the money at the time, but like, it was also, I don't know, the first couple of books, because they're more concerned with kings and the world, it didn't feel like I needed as strong a sense of the landscape, whereas because reading the Icelandic sagas, it's such a story of the landscape and the landscape, you know, it's such a particular kind of landscape. It was right about drafting. I was drafting at the time, but I was definitely feeling not blocked in the sense I can't write anything, but I felt like I wasn't getting the intensity and the detail in the writing that I wanted for it. So I went with my dad and did that. But yeah, so the Althing is real. Lots of the cultures, lots of the customs in there is real. I mean, my draw is unreliable source text. That seems to be the thing that... because it gives you... It's fun, you know, partly because it's the fun of the what if, how did this happen? You know, my source text for the first couple of books, Herodotus' Histories, is famously this crazy ragbag collection of some really good, well-sourced historical facts, you know, and lots of myth and folklore. And the same with the Icelandic sagas. Lots of them were real people. These characters are not, but people like
You know, Hrap the ghost at the start, Olaf the peacock,
yeah,
you know, various, there's various other characters within it who were, most of the characters who have cameos in it are sort of like, are in the sagas and were probably real people, you know, they, you know, people can trace their genealogies back. But then there's lots of, like, again, myth and folklore and strangeness to it as well. And as a kind of vanished world of which there's some record, but not so much. There's license to improvise as well. So I try to do a lots of, but I guess the research for me is I'm researching for narrative opportunity, you know, not a kind of encyclopedic knowledge. You know, when I'm reading source material, I'm looking for stuff that's really interesting. So things like the All Thing, that's again, that's great because it's like, that's a really good opportunity to bring a load of characters together into one place, you know. So, and yeah, obviously it happens, it occurs like a third of the way through the novel, just when you want to kick things up a notch. So you're looking, you know, and the same with discovering the jewel, you know, the home gang, this kind of ritual jewel that's fought with a kind of tag team style on a, you know, deer hide. You know, that was something that is also in a number of the sagas. And again, that was something where you read it and you're like, this is a great opportunity. I'm going to, you know, obviously I'm gonna have this in it because it's such a... So I do a lot of research, but it's primarily, it's less about trying to do a kind of very slavish or elaborate recreation of the period, which I think is kind of impossible anyway.
Yeah.
It's more, how can I use the information here to tell an interesting story?
You're researching, but as a writer.
Like, I mean, and some of the stuff I teach at university is based around that as well. It's sort of like, this is, you know, it's a different skill, you know, to... just, you know, to, you know, academic or, you know, cultural or whatever kind of research. Researching as a writer, you're looking for narrative more than anything else.
How old is the Icelandic saga? Like, when was it written?
Yeah, so they were written down in, I think it was about, there's a variety because there was no written language originally until it was Christianized. They were written down, and I think it was like sort of 13th and 14th century. The stories have been around for hundreds of years, you know, and a lot of them had been, you know, the setting is around, usually most of it's in the kind of 10th century and, you know, in the aftermath of the events, lots of these oral tales were being told over and over again.
Yeah.
And then when it came to the 13th or 14th century, they started writing them down once they'd been through a few hundred years of sort of Chinese whispers and elaborations and that sort of thing.
Okay, so what writing are you most proud of?
I think it's The Smile of the Wolf so far. I mean, obviously, I've got a work in one always wants to feel one's getting better, you know, sort of like, of course. Every writer wants, there's a great gag, I think it's a Tom Stoppard play, where it's like, every writer wants to feel they're getting better, but most people just prefer the old stuff, you know. Sort of, but no, I mean, I was really proud of The Smile of the Wolf. I think it was a progression from the first, which I'm still very proud of, and of the first couple of books. And they've got quite, they do have a quality of, debut novels, early novels, they have this quality of kind of mad. You try everything, you have no fear sort of stuff. Yeah. So in some ways, you know, they're often very flawed and very uneven, but they do have a kind of, they can have a kind of crazy brilliance to them sometimes.
Yeah.
But I feel like with The Smile of the Wolf, you know, in terms of use of the first person narrator was something I always found hard. So I found that really interesting to do. And just, I think I just, you know, the use of the source material was really interesting. I just feel like I got at some stuff and was able to kind of push the writing further than I'd been able to before. So yeah, I'd say it's the book I'm most proud of so far.
What is the hardest part of writing for you?
Hardest part of writing? Middles are really hard. You know, the middle's the miserable middle is sort of, it's really difficult, you know.
It's really difficult.
Yeah, beginnings I love. Opening scenes, they're so much fun to write. Yeah. You know, you just bring people into the world. You can always find a dramatic scene to kind of bring people in. Everything's really exciting. There's loads of possibilities there. And endings are really delightful as well, because just the way in which, if it's gone well, just things tie together and resolve. You know, it's got that kind of musical quality of things resolving. Middles are just hard. I mean, I plan a bit and I have things that I'm aiming for, but I do kind of improvise somewhat as well in the middle. Yeah. Maybe if I was, but I feel like, it's the way I have to work anyway. Every writer works differently. But for me, because I like to improvise, I don't want to have a fixed plan, because a lot of the joy of discovery in the writing is fun for me. And hopefully keeps it, you know, because there's stuff like you were talking about with Sigrid, you know, there's stuff like that where, you know, that stuff doesn't come in until I'm in it. And so it surprises me and therefore hopefully surprises the reader too. But it just means that, you know, middles, they're just, everything's in the air, nothing is finished. There's loads of moving parts going on.
Yeah.
So everything that you're doing is trying to build off something you've done before and set up something in the future. There's just loads to, and also just, you know, you're, for me, you know, I'll be like 6 months or a year into the draft. You're just tired. You're really, really tired. You've been working on it in the dark for ages. Like it's, and the first draft is always really messy anyway, and the middle is the messiest bit of it. So it's just, you know, there's, I always think there's, and you know, every writer is different, but there's lots of writers have talk about the two despair points in writing a novel. These are about 30,000 words. You really hit the wall the first time. You just don't know, I don't know how this is going to work. I don't think, you know, I think this is terrible. I don't know how I'm going to finish. And then about 60 or 70,000 words, sometimes you've got the feeling of like, I'm definitely going to finish. I don't know if anyone else is going to care about this because I've been stuck in this book myself for so long that I have no frame of reference or judgment or whether or not it's working at all. So... those are the two that they kind of bracket the miserable middle, basically.
The middle of it, I heard a quote a while ago. I'm not sure who said it, but it was a writer, and he said that some writers are architects and some writers are gardeners.
Mm.
Like, what would you say is more you? Or, I mean, obviously we're a hybrid of the both.
Yeah, I cheat and say it's like a secret option. I think of myself as like a navigator. You know, I always think of it as being like. I'm on a kind of dark ocean at night. It's quite it's quite a still ocean. It's not that scary, but it is dark and kind of threatening. And there are these points of light. There are these kind of lighthouses or waypoints for me to go towards. You know, usually in a book, particularly historical fiction, because sometimes I'm drawing it from my source material. Yeah. There'll be sort of three or four or five really big events that will just shake everything up. So again, you know, in Smile of the Wolf, it was the obviously the opening scene, the killing. Then there's the all thing is the next turn. Then the decision not to leave, then there's the return, you know, and then there's the kind of final confrontation. And so when I started out, I didn't, you know, some of them were tweaks, but, you know, I had those kind of big beats pretty in my mind as I was going. I just didn't know how I was going to get between them. So I'm kind of like, I'm at this point and I know where I am now and I know I've got to get over there somehow. So yeah, basically it's a kind of hybrid approach. I plan some stuff, but there's improvising in between these kind of... waypoints or points of light.
Yeah, that's really a beautiful way to describe it, points of light. So the next question is, how do you keep writing and motivated?
Yeah, I mean, mostly it's just habit and discipline for me. You know, I sort of try and set, you know, my daily word count goal is 400 words a day. Sometimes I fall short of, sometimes I oversee, you know, go over it, but it's roughly kind of what I'm going for. Try and do that 6 days a week, get a day off every week to kind of recharge. So really it's just, you know, for me it's the habit and the discipline to keep doing it. And it is, it's hard and, you know, the middle is hard and, you know, sometimes it's boring work as well, bizarrely, but it is always fulfilling. And I think, I suppose, the more you do it, it remains frightening and terrifying just because of the nature of it, but you also know that it is also satisfying and fulfilling work, and you do gain confidence slowly in your ability that things do come together, that stuff does work out, you do figure it out in that sense. So in the long term, it's having that in mind. In the short term, it's just that knowledge that if I just keep writing, try and resist the urge to go back and edit, you know, I always keep moving forward in the draft as well. It's the idea that I will finish it, you know, if I just do my 500 a day, you know, that's, you know, with 6 days a week, that's 3,000 a week, you know, with so every month it's, you know, 10,000 or 12,000. And, you know, if I just keep doing that, I know it doesn't feel like it right now. It feels like it's impossible. I'll never finish it. But if I can just keep plodding forward, eventually I'm going to finish the thing.
And how many drafts does that like usually involve, like creating a novel? How many drafts?
It varies from book to book. I mean, it's for me, it's usually... It's usually about, I'd say about three or four big, like at least three big rewrites. Not often rewriting huge amounts of the text, but there'll be big editorial stuff going on where stuff gets shuffled around, sections get rewritten, sections get cut, repositioned, new material goes in, where you make quite dramatic changes to the text for about two or three, sometimes four drafts if you're... If the structure is a real struggle, basically. And then once that's happened, then there's just a, you know, I stop keeping count after a while because, but they're all kind of polishy drafts after that. You know, I'd say there's like, somewhere between three and four usually big structural edits. And then there's, you know, polish after polish after polish where you just keep running through it. You know, and if you're in a traditional publishing situation, you know, the agent reads it, gives you some feedback. Then the editor reads it, gives you some feedback. Then the copy editor reads it, gives you some feedback. Then the proofreader reads it, gives you some final feedback. And, you know, just kind of keep polishing away.
Yeah. For aspiring and emerging young writers, what's the best advice you can share?
I always think it's a combination of sort of persistence, patience, and curiosity. Persistence is, you know, it's that discipline. It's that idea of, I'm going to keep going. It's going to take, you know, the patience is, it's going to take a while. You know, sort of thing for most people, 10 years to make a writer gets talked about, which I think is probably true, more or less. You can shave some years off it. Sometimes it takes longer. But it's a long process, you know, to get the skills up if it's the desire to kind of be professional and get kind of work out there. And the curiosity aspect is always that just remaining alive to possibilities, you know. So for me, things like historical fiction, you know, if I'd got locked in at 18 and I was like, I am a fantasy writer or I'm a literary fiction writer, or if, you know, if I'd had my one book that I was absolutely going to do and been really rigid about it, or I'd been, I only write in the mornings, I only do this, you know, everything is changeable and everything is to be played with and, you know, to look at what's working, what's not working, how can I get better, you know, just that constant process of kind of development and willing to kind of engage with it like that, I think is, in a self-flagellating, oh, I'm terrible, I'm never going to get anywhere. It's like, oh, how interesting, what can I do differently, how can I keep learning and developing, you know.
Yeah,
I think, you
and
know.
For everyone it's completely different.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of that, that would be the other one that I would definitely say is that, you know, it's why teaching creative writing is strange, but a lot of it is around saying everyone's process and methodology is different. These are some stuff that I, you know, people tend to, particularly for novels, like, you know, some kind of discipline and habit tends to work better for most people. You know, there's some shared principles and shared knowledge. A bit of planning does go a long way. But, you know, you learn your stuff, you know, like Stephen King does 2,000 words a day and, you know, Graham Greene wrote exactly 400 words a day and James Joyce was lucky to get 7, you know, everyone is different, you know, so.
There's some writers as well that will just do it, like, in 1 month. Like, I think, you know, The Remains of the Day by... He wrote that in 1 month, I think. He just went on a retreat somewhere and...
Yeah.
I wish I could do like that.
Sort of like, some people, I mean, you know, often for them, you know, and there's other writers that I know who've done that, often for them, the planning process and the research process is a lot more elaborate and it's all building and building and building. And then they can just smash it in a month, you know, to get the draft out.
Yeah. So finally, what are you working on at the moment?
I'm always a little coy about talking about, but partly because sometimes it just doesn't work. You know, sometimes projects kind of fall away the wayside.
That's true.
But the thing I've got at the moment, I'm working, it's historical fiction again, and Unreliable Source Texts again. It's a very, my coy sort of teaser for it is that it's a very unlikely theory about a very famous mythological figure. And I'm hoping for it to be part of a series. I'd like it to be 3 books or so this time. So I'd like to stretch my legs out and expand further.
Okay, well, thank you for coming here tonight on this beautiful Sheffield evening.
Yeah, it's gorgeous out there. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been great fun.